on a spot.
I'm not getting a clear picture of what it plays back. If you have auto tracking, it looks like it's trying to go through the tracking. That would be an indication of no control track. So, and as far as what Rich was talking about, let me let it drop.
So let me give you a quick breakdown of what I heard Paul say. When he takes a commercial tape or a tape that has been recorded on some other machine and plays it on the questionable machine, no sweat. So obviously the control track seems to be working then. However, on the questionable machine, when he makes a recording there, he cannot play it back on the machine it was recorded, and the recording that he makes on the questionable machine, when he plugs that tape into another machine, it does not play the video back correctly. Back to you, Eric.
Yeah, that would be a record issue. Whereas you can play anything fine, but his recordings are bad. And if I have a little more information as how the recordings are bad, what the actual picture looks like, I can give you more clues to where the problem is. You can actually have bench rollers cause problems like that, because if the tape is riding up off the edge of the control track, it won't produce any control track, but a lot of the machines with the automatic tracking will be able to actually find the picture of something being played back in it, because it will actually go three tracks in terms of up and down. So if the tape was riding up a little bit, it would still track and play back and look fine, but yet the recording will have no control track. So that's one possibility. Of course, another possibility is that the record electronics isn't working right and it's not producing the FM for one of the two heads, or both heads. So, there you go. Now, I wanted to get to what Rich was saying. Rich, there are no new standards and old standards. There are compatible standards between one another. What you're probably talking about is VHS Hi-Fi, was that a lot of commercially produced stuff on the main content, there'll be Hi-Fi audio, and then at the end of the credits, the Hi-Fi audio goes away, and the machine's supposed to be smart enough to switch back to the longitudinal track. So, and if one of your heads are not sitting in the right place, when it goes to set up the tracking at a Hi-Fi, and it doesn't necessarily agree with the video head, one or the other you lose. So, there you go. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, he did record. Paul did tell us that on the questionable machine, playing it back or taking the recording of the questionable machine into some other machine, he gets instances of playback which fade in and fade out, if I understand correctly. Certainly does sound like there's not enough volume and frequency of the control being laid down as a and hopefully cleaning those heads. So the control track, does that lay down and play similar to the audio of the helical scan, a head that's laying a report now?
Every time that head makes a rotation of half the drum, it's a 60th of a second, it's one field of information with every swipe that goes down. That's actually 3 milliseconds each swipe. Sorry, 16.6 milliseconds. 33 milliseconds is two swipes. And every time that thing comes by, on every second swipe, what it does in a longitudinal head, it actually creates a saturating pulse. And the control track is actually what we call saturating track. So what it does is it put a little tick mark there, which really indicates when the pole tip of the head is right at the entrance. And by the way, guides, the two little things that wrap the head around, the tape around the drum, their positioning is rather critical. If you look at the actual output of the limiter of the VCR, you'll actually see an envelope. And when everything is right, it's a perfectly rectangular envelope. But if the tape is not following the guide, or the guides that actually hold the tape up against the drum are not holding the tape in exactly the right place, that nice rectangular envelope that you just see won't be rectangular. I have crossovers in it all over the place.
So you still feel with that scenario you just drew for us, Paul, that the recording process for the control function is more critical than playback. So his questionable machine could be improperly laying down control for a whole bunch of reasons, And I'm having a little trouble with the head alignment and pinch roller problem, because why would it still be so beautiful on playback of a recording from any other machine or a commercial tape? Back to you, Eric.
K2KEY, what a question on that?
All right, I'll give it to you in a second. The reason why, Dick, is that you got to consider the width of that tape is a half inch, okay? If it says the control track's on the bottom, the control track's width is, I don't remember exactly, but it's pretty tiny. And if the tape rides up just a teeny little bit, say it, you know, a little more than a hundredth of an inch, it's not going to put those saturating tracks down on the tape, so the next tape machine is going to have some trouble with it. But the tape machine that he happens to be in, even though it's doing that to a tape that's been properly recorded, is going to A, see a little bit of it, and B, the automatic tracking will be able to compensate for the error of the tape writing up. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, I want to ask Paul one question. This is K2KEY. Do you have a manual tracking control also on a machine? Now, some of them have it. To go to manual tracking, you pull it out, and it's like a switch that switches it to manual tracking. Do you have the manual tracking control also, Paul, over?
Oh, yeah, see, I tried it. I could go up and down with that, and you could just, you know, what happens is it looks like it's trying to bring it back, but then it stops and just gets worse. It just comes back on its own. The automatic tracking apparently is working, looking for it to find it. And to answer the question, like Eric had a question about what does the picture look like. Well, if you were watching a space shuttle launch and you guys got down to 1 minute before launch, the next, I'd say, 53 seconds or so would be perfect. The next 7 seconds, you're going to start seeing the picture get fuzzy, white lines crossing it, and eventually the picture will disappear, and you'll just see all the lines, horizontal lines, white lines, noise crossing that picture. And then at the launch, you're not going to see anything. I mean, the signal will actually go away, and my TV says, a loss of signal. The next 7 seconds, you'll start to see it come back. It'll be reversed. It'll be coming back until 7 seconds later. Perfect. I mean, perfect for the next 1 minute, and you get to see the space shuttle to leave the Earth. Mel, back to you. Yes, it does have tracking, and I even put the cleaner in, and I operated the tracking buttons with the cleaner in it, thinking, well, maybe the cleaner wasn't hitting that part of it. Maybe it would move. Maybe the tape would move, something like that. By the way, when the tracking is automatically searching for it, what's moving? Is the tape moving? Is there a mechanical head moving? What's moving? What's tracking? Or is it all electronic? Back to you, Mel.
Okay, it's all electronic. So the tracking is all electronic tracking system. It's looking for the proper spot. Now, here's what to do. Very simple to test that. I've done that so many times. So you take what I used to use, I used to have, of course, a test tape. You put in a commercial tape into it that you said works correctly. In the manual tracking position, you're going to swing that tracking control from one end to another. It should stay in pretty much from one end to another in tracking. You may see it start to go out on any of the extreme ends of the control. If it's going correctly like that, then the tracking head is correctly aligned and correctly working. And the problem is, electronically, what it's doing is laying down a bad control track. That's the way I checked them many, many times. That told me right away, am I a mechanical problem or am I having an electronic problem? By using a pre-recorded tape and letting it run, if it runs properly, you see it on the auto tracking, you go to the manual tracking. Now, by swinging that control from one end to another, you should see it just slightly go out of tracking. You see those lines coming up from the bottom? at either extreme. If you do, then the tracking head is working correctly and the mechanics are correct, but now you have an electronic problem of laying down the track, Paul. This is how I checked many, many machines and never missed by that method. Back to you, Dick.
Thank you, Andy.
So you're right. I've done that. That makes it an electrical problem, according to what you just said now. Dick?
Barry, and then we're eventually going to get to Gary. Gary, hang in there. Barry, what have you done on a case like this?
Okay, well, I just want to mention that he might have bad tape. And if you've recorded on a bad tape, you can't correct it. You know, it's always going to be crummy like that. So he just might have lousy tape. And even if he re-records, in other words, if the alignment was out when he made that recording, if the vertical alignment of the tape wasn't right because of the guide pins, you know, if they weren't properly aligned, he could actually have damaged the bottom or the top of the tape. Now, if that happens, once he's done that, it's never going to work right again.
All right, let me stop you guys for a second. First of all, if a machine has misaligned guides, it will play back on itself just fine because it's playing back. And to think that, you know, a commercially made tape is always right and they have the right interchange, it's called interchange. It's not necessarily always the case because a lot of these places, the duplicators, they use them, they wear, they change, they shift. And when you're adjusting the tracking control, actually, there is no tracking head, it's a video head, there's two video heads. What you're doing is you're changing the phase relationship, or you're changing the relationship of where the tip of that head in that drum is. When you turn the tracking knob, you're actually changing where that head thinks the beginning of video is, and there's also another circuit in there. There's actually two Miller integrators. There's one that controls where the tape physically is. So you really have to control where the tape physically is, and that's what you're doing with the tracking control. You're also changing the phase relationship of where the head is actually beginning to touch the tape. So if you have tape that's moving at a linear speed of 7.5 or 3 3/3 inches per second across the drum, and you have another head that is actually spinning and touching the tape every 16 milliseconds, it actually enters the tape. The relationship of where the track begins and where the head sees the beginning of the track is what's being controlled by the tracking control. Now also, if you've got no control track, and as you say, it locks up for a while and then it goes away, if you turn the tracking knob with it slower, you can probably keep it locked, but it sounds like that head is free running. So, there you go. K2RW, KE2Z.
Yeah, the impression I'm getting, Eric, is that, just to make a simplistic example, the saturated track for timing gives you an impulse, and if the machine is set up in a particular manner, the helical scan head at that instant of time will be, I'm going to give an example, 12 o'clock. And as you advance the tracking control, it will force the tip coming out of the control track to occur at the time that the helical scanning head is at 1 o'clock, and that you're advancing, and at 11 o'clock if you're retarding. So you're shifting the phase of where the head starts the swipe across the tape. And when it starts that swipe early or late, the swipe is now of the moving head, the helical scan head, is either down the center of that helical recording that was laid down. That gives you the best possible signal-to-noise ratio. And as you make phasing error, you're getting less and less signal because of the misalignment, the tape being too far forward or too far back in its transport. In other words, the helical scanning head being late or early when it starts, and not only do you pick up less of the desired information, you're starting to pick up the adjacent helical scan track, which really represents a kind of co-channel interference. Am I at all close with these guesses, Eric? KE2EJ, K2LIW?
Oh, that's very good, Dick. Actually, where the tape actually hits the head,
is where vertical, the vertical sync pulse begins. And actually just a tad before the vertical sync pulse. It's actually line 10 where the head switching occurs. So the whole concept of changing the head's position is that when the track is properly aligned with the split so that you're going to read the whole track, the idea now is to have the head actually be in time correctly for the next vertical sync pulse. And that's where this whole issue of time-based error comes about, but that's a whole other story. But, so there's two things that have to happen. The phase of the tape moving past the entire assembly, when it's in the right position, you'll notice there's a slot in the drum that's a helical shape. That's what it actually has to line up with, so that the head comes by and gets the maximum output of that stripe of magnetic information. The tip of the head has to hit the head, hit the tape exactly at the right point where the vertical sync pulse is laid down in the magnetic information. So there's two things going on there. And as if you miss track, what you wind up doing is your head actually starts to pick up the adjacent track, and that literally looks like interference line by line. That's what the breaking up of the picture is.
Okay, I'm starting to get the picture here. Paul, was your machine subjected to any kind of grief before this error began? Had anyone dropped it? Had you loaned it to a friend who told you he's going to treat it with tender loving care, but maybe he didn't? Is there any kind of mischief, grief, or trauma that you believe the machine could possibly have been subjected to? Did somebody drop it, or did an object drop on the machine? Over to you, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
No, no, but the bother. No, all my equipment here, I mean, you know, I mean, it's not a NASA clean room, but it's close to it, and I treat everything like one of the mechanics, the technicians that would be working at NASA. You know, I'm careful with the disc. I'm careful with the tape. Every tape comes out, goes back in a box. That's the way I am with all my equipment, ham gear, everything. So, it's just nothing mechanical. My grandkids didn't put a peanut butter sandwich in there, try to make toast or anything. Nothing like that, Dick. So, I know it hasn't been dropped, hasn't been moved in the 3 years it's sitting there outside of cleaning around it. It's not that. Not that kind of a problem, Dick. And by the way, Eric mentioned the flying erase head. It doesn't have that. It's got the erase head. When you look at the machine, it looks like on the left-hand side, you got the erase head. Let me drop it. And then you've got a little light source. You know, when the tape goes by and it's clear and it's... Photocell picks up the clear thing. You've got that there. Picks up the clear tape. That's next, and then you've got your drum spinning. And then to the right of that, you've got what I believe is the audio head. And it's pretty. I mean, it's pretty big. Up there, half inch horizontal. For the tape to go by. My question is, everything I've looked on the internet diagrams, it really doesn't say where the control head is. It shows you where this audio head is. But is the control head part of this audio system? They have it ganged together. It's one above the other. Apparently, Eric is saying it's at the bottom of the article I read. They showed the control at the top. There's a conflict there, but... Physically, where is this head? Is it attached to the same head that this audio tape is? That would be another question, because I'm definitely going to clean this thing first. I got nothing to lose there, and I just want to make sure I'm looking at the right head here. Back to you, Dick.
Eric probably wants to give a comment on that. Go ahead, Eric.
Okay. You take a magnifying glass, you look at the audio head. You'll see at the top there's two little horizontal lines. If you look at the bottom of it, there's another little horizontal line. That's on the bottom, that's the control track head. the two little slits on the top of the left and right hand channels of the audio head. It's all in the same fixture. So, and that race head you're talking about is a full race head. What I was talking about is something called a flying race head that looks like another video head. It's actually on the drum and it spins. And it will actually erase a single magnetic stripe so that you can lay down a new one without any interference. And by the way, the hi-fi, you find this interesting, Dick, the video head is oriented in one direction, and the hi-fi head is actually oriented 180 degrees, the opposite tilt. So it's, you know, they're relying on the 20 dB of cross-polarization between the two magnetic fields to keep them separate. K2RW, K2J.
KC2VSO listening.
VSO recognized. We got to get to Gary also. KB2, I think that was VSO. A little bit noisy. I've heard about that one, where if you tilt the recording head of a conventional audio recorder, tilt it, let me pick a number, 45 degrees to the right and make a recording, and take that exact same recording head, or typical audio recording, not video now, and tilt it 45 degrees to the left and make a recording, there's quite a bit of isolation between the two, and now in a hi-fi machine, it can use them both simultaneously with some kind of a correlation function. Let's see what Gary, I know that Gary's wanted to make a comment for some time here. KB2JXM. Gary, go right ahead. K2RIW on the TechNet. My name is Dick.
Actually, that's wrong, Dick, but I'll straighten you out later.
Roger. Go ahead, Gary, first. KB2JXM, Gary, are you there? Looks like we kept Gary waiting a little bit too long. Sorry about that. Maybe I tilted too far, but I'd like to believe if the head is wide enough in the conventional audio recording scheme, it picks up very little of the original audio if it's not properly aligned between recording and playback. And so there is some isolation between the two, I thought. Straighten me out of that one, Eric, go ahead.
Yeah, first of all, the difference between hi-fi and regular audio is less noise and wider bandwidth. And the way they do that is it's not a stationary head that's being recorded longitudinally. You look at the video head, it has a certain tilt. From a hi-fi head, it looks like another video head. It's actually laying FM down on a tape. But it's actually 90 degrees of reverse polarization of the video head. So you're actually getting two different kinds of track. Because when you think about the gap of a longitudinal head and you tilt it, what you're actually doing is because you're really just reducing the size, the width of the track. So, I mean, it is important to make sure that your audio track or your audio head is absolutely parallel with the track to get the maximum output from it. And that's a simple saturating, it's not saturating track, but it's a biased track with usually 32 or 48 kilohertz worth of bias to set the magnetic particles up. And most people don't realize what makes magnetic tape work is that while the oxide is wet, it's actually passed through a magnetic field to line all the pole places up in a certain direction. You line them up actually longitudinally with the tape to make the maximum coupling between the head and the actual magnetic particle. But in the high writing speed of the hi-fi head, it actually records at a slightly different layer and a different axis of the tape itself. But the two heads are actually 90 degrees tilted from one another.
Okay, if a hi-fi machine is laying down the video in a conventional manner, but the audio is another helical scan. The way the helical scan works is that the tape is wrapped around the drum by the mechanics of the rollers and the way the thing sets itself up when you first plug the tape in. So the tape is wrapped around the roller approximately 360 degrees. The rotating helical scan head is laying down a narrow track that scans across a very long distance of tape with a slight tilt angle to it. I'm going to pick a number out of the air, 10 degrees. So it's 10 degrees from parallel is the video track helical scan. If now the audio helical scan is set up the other way, one is tilted 10 degrees up, one is tilted 10 degrees down, they're crossed from each other, but still they're not quite at right angles, if I understand correctly. Back to you, Eric, K2RIW.
Yeah, well, you have to think about it this way, that you have a round disc, you know, like a quarter, but bigger, okay, and there's a motor in the center of it, which makes it spin. Since it is a straight line, okay, we mount the heads around the circumference of this disc, and those heads zip by in a straight line. The way that you get the helical is by making the tilt, the tape tilt from entrance to exit across the wrap. Called an Omega app. And actually the tilt of like the VHS I think is like 18 degrees, something like that. And the actual pole tip of the VHF Hi-Fi head is tilted the other way than the gap is for the video head. They do use different carrier frequencies, so that offers another isolation between the two of them. But they both follow exactly the same track path as the video head. It's not like one head is higher than the other, so you're putting down a track in between the two tracks, if you follow what I'm saying.
I sure am. I now realize that the Omega wrap can only have one angle. I mean, it wraps roughly 360 degrees, but the way it wraps creates this 18-degree tilt, and that they can only do one tilt. I was proposing a scheme where there's two separate tilts. Well, you'd have to have a pair of Omega wraps on different lengths along the tape itself to do that, and they didn't do that. But the recording head itself has got a very narrow gap to it. I think you're saying that gap is tilted with reference to the angle at which it scans. And so there's a tilt for the video and a tilt for the hi-fi audio. Is that what you're saying? Of the actual gap of the thing that's being doing the helical scanning. Back to you, Eric, K2RIW.
Yeah, well, you know, the thickness of the head is only 12 microns. So if you look at it on this flat platter, the gap looks straight up and down. But if you look at the gap of the audio, the flying audio head, it's tilted, I think, to the left. Some number between 45 and 90 degrees. Let's call it 45 degrees, if you're looking at it that way. So it causes a different kind of saturation in the tape, which also gives them a little bit of isolation. Because the magnetic particles on the tape are lined up perfectly left and right, this cross-polarization of making these particles line up actually causes a little tilt, and that gives you that 20 dB of isolation between one carrier and the other. It's as though you're putting two carriers down with one head, except that you're using two heads to do it.
Okay, now I've got a problem. If the audio helical scan head has one kind of tilt and is running at one particular carrier frequency, the video scan head has a slightly different tilt to its gap, but it's scanning the exact same way across the tape, and that's a hi-fi tape. How compatible is a hi-fi tape on a non-hi-fi machine? Back to you, Eric.
It's perfectly compatible. If you've got a really good eye, you'll actually see a very slight little bit of herringbone from it. But for all practical purposes, it's 40 dB down, and it's like, that's fine.
Okay. Is the tilt of the video on the hi-fi machine equal to the tilt of the video on a non-hi-fi machine? I'm guessing the answer is yes. On a non-hi-fi machine, it is the transverse scan head that's doing the laydown of the audio, and that's probably still taking place on the hi-fi machine, but there's some additional higher fidelity audio on a tilted helical scan head. Is that approximately what's going on? Back to you, Eric.
Yeah, all hi-fi machines have the longitudinal head, The non hi-fi machines don't have a hi-fi head on the helical scan head, the one that's laying tracks down at an angle. And a hi-fi machine has a head which lays tracks down at an angle, at a very high writing speed, which is actually the same writing speed as the video hit.
I can see that. Now, I've got a problem. If I take a hi-fi recorded tape, play it on a non-hi-fi machine, the presence of the audio being there with a different tilt angle of the gap of the helical scanning head, the fact that the audio is on the tape in that manner could give you a very slight herringbone because of the beating of the carrier frequencies and that other piece of material, other piece of recorded information is on the same piece of magnetic tape. How in the world does a hi-fi machine avoid that herringbone presence in its video? Over to you, Eric.
Simple. It's a little pi network that blocks out that frequency.
Okay. And I think you're saying that the manufacturers of a non-hi-fi machine were not smart enough to anticipate that they needed a notch filter for that heterodyning signal. Is that true?
Yeah, well, once hi-fi came into being, then non-hi-fi machines started getting manufactured with those little notch filters in them. So. But still, nothing in the analog world is perfect. And if you really look very carefully, you'll see a little herringbone. But then again, VHS is really god-awful video to start with. You know, I'm used to machines that cost $40,000 or $50,000, and they don't make god-awful video.
Now, can this assembled group of people with a whole lot of gray matter give Paul some suggestions as to what he should do next? He's going to do a thorough cleaning job. He's going to do a very careful alignment, careful observation of anything funny going on with the mechanical transport as far as worn guides and improper rolling of bearings that are transporting the tape and so on. Once he completes all of that, if his problem on the troubled machine exists, still exists, what would you suggest he do next, Eric, to try to do a divide and conquer on this particular problem? Because like all of us, Paul values the information, values the equipment that he's had for some time. It's got brand loyalty. It appears to be a subtle error of some kind. He'd like to put it back on the air. KE2EJ, KE2LIW.
Right, K2RW, K2J. Well, if I was going to fix it, first of all, you need a scope. And it's really helpful if you have a manual or a schematic, because it not only tells you about the electrical stuff, it tells you about the mechanical stuff. And then, of course, you need a standard or alignment tape. But what I would probably do is make sure that there's no buildup of crap in the guides, because that'll do it, especially in the lower guides, to cause the tape to ripple or move slightly. And actually, I clean everything by hand with a Kim wipe and alcohol, and sometimes with a toothbrush, not on the head, but the guides, stuff like that, to make sure it's clean. It only takes a little second step to throw everything off. We're talking about thousands of an inch here. And the fact that the plastic stuff works is, like, totally amazing. If you look at the early VTRs, they had very well-crafted machine metal guides to make sure that the tape rides down the rabbet of the drum properly. Anyway. What I would do first, if I don't have the schematics, I'll actually hook the scope across the control track head, and I'll find the two little pins that come out the back that relate to the head that's at the bottom of that stack, and look to see if this control track pulse is coming out. And if they look good and they're well formed, and they will occur, they will actually be there every 30th of a second, and every 15th of a second, you'll see a double pulse, which is actually a culturing pulse. So if that stuff is there, I know I'm good mechanically. Then I'll actually go and look at the Miller Integrator that runs the thing that pulls the tape along and see if that's locked up and it has a little pick in it. If it doesn't, then you know you're going to replace the servo chip, because in these VCRs these days, what used to take three boards is now one little, you know, 50 or 75 pin IC that handles all the jobs in there. But the reality is, VHS machines can be bought for $50. I mean, why would you make yourself crazy?
Well, like all of us hams, Paul, I am guessing, is the kind of guy who takes pride in fixing things. He's not doing it to be economically practical or to be practical in man hours spent versus benefit he gets. He's got a machine that he's fallen in love with that used to work, and if it's going to take him 8 hours of his labor to get it back on the air, and it's only in dollars and cents worth 4 hours of his labor, he's quite possibly going to spend the 8 hours. He may not do it all in one day, he could do it on two separate weekends, but I'll bet you he's going to do it. I'm putting words in Paul's mouth. Let's see what Paul's got to say about this. WS2N, K2LIW.
It's the way to my mind, Dick, because I think he says a JVC, over.
Okay, I heard both Rich and Mel, but let's hear a couple of words from Paul first. Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, it's a Magnavox. It's, I think when I read JVC, eventually started making Magnavoxes. That's probably how that came up before now, but it's a Magnavox. But it's a combo unit. It records on VHS and it records on DVD. And the reason I bought it is for dubbing purposes. I could take information from a VHS and put it onto a DVD, and you can go the other way around. You can put the DVD onto the VHS, and you can go back and forth, and you can play around, and you can really do some nice editing, cut things out that you don't want. So, I mean, I could do it with another. I could take the other VHS machine, bring it up, and run, you know, composite wise into the two machines and do it that way, you know. No problem. But, it sure is convenient to have the one machine. And you put a tape in one and put a DVD in the other, and you could, you know, switch back and forth until your heart's content. So, that's what's nice about these things. The DVD are, of course, very good. You know, you can make thumbnail pictures. You could type in whatever you want, whatever it is. Of course, you can't do that on the tape, but by the time you're done and you have it all on the DVD, you can really do some nice work. So that's the reason I'm trying to keep it alive. They have new machines for under $200 that do the same thing without the tuner. Right? This one does have a tuner. The ones that you can buy now, most of them under that price range do not have a tuner. You need a box before, either a satellite box or a cable box or something, to do what I'm doing. And then you might also have copyright problems with the digital signals coming in, where you won't have that with the tuner. So that's the reason behind everything. Dick, over to you, WS2.
Becomes a little bit more understandable why that machine is valuable to you. Rich and Mel in that order. Rich and N2EO, go ahead.
Okay, Dick, I want to get back to, you know, I pulled a couple of tapes out here. Same movie, 30 Seconds Over Tokyo. One says, Hi-Fi VHS, released by MGM. The other is Warner Brothers, same movie. I tried both of these on the same VCR. A friend of mine tried them on his VCR. We got the same result. So that is that one copy plays fine. The other one, it looks like a tracking problem, but it's not a tracking problem. The picture jumps in and out. You'll get maybe 30 seconds of picture. The screen will go to a blue field. Then it'll come back up. And I don't think it's the tape, because I have other tapes that do the same thing. Now, I had questions. I hope Barry is listening. I forget what he had told me. Barry and 2MB said there's a sequence you have to push on some of these machines. I think he said the tracking pulse, as I recall. Some of these machines some of these tapes are laid down to use a separate tracking head. Others, I believe, the tracking is on the video head. I think what Paul may be running into is one standard is working on one machine, one is working on the other. I don't know if I'm making myself clear, but maybe Barry is in there and he remembers what he told me. M2EF.
Barry, are you still there? Eric, I got a quick question on what Rich just said. I am going to make a guess that at least one of those tapes has various kinds of copyright protection. It is my impression that many of the schemes for copyright protection cut into the integrity of the sync pulses, and therefore a slightly older machine can have a lot more trouble acquiring proper synchronization when a tape with copyright protection is inserted in the machine. Have there been instances like that one, Eric? K2EJ, K2RIW? Okay, maybe Eric is not right there. Mel also wanted to make some comments on all this. K2KEY, go right ahead, Mel.
Okay, going to a blue picture and dropping out, as you said, copyright. A number of the tapes that were copywritten that way will produce that kind of effect. Those are bootleg tapes that were copied. That's what the difference could be. Some of them, they look legitimate, but you can buy them in the city. You know, you see these guys sitting on the in front of a store that's closed, like on Sunday, with a lot of these bootleg tapes of famous movies and even recent movies. Some of the stuff is real just plain junk, but usually that's some of the effects you'll get when they try to copy a protected tape, like a copy protection type of pulse that was built into that. I know Disney started that because there was so much bootlegging of their tapes, their videotapes. However, in Paul's case, I'm searching back in my memory, and the one thing that came to mind that I had was JVC machines, servicing JVC. They had a chronic problem, like exactly the way he described. Let me let it drop in, and I'll explain it in detail. The complaint was that, again, you could take any tape from another machine that was working properly, or a tape that you rented, any tape, and put it in the machine, and it would play beautiful, indicating that mechanically that machine was working properly. Only when you went to make your own recording, you neither could play it back on your machine properly, nor play it back on any other machine properly, which of course told me that there's something wrong with the way the track was being, the recording synchronization track was being laid down. The problem was on JVC and a couple of other machines that would show up after a couple of years. I remember they had a little relay. They had a couple of little mechanical relays that about a half inch long by a quarter of inch thick. They sit on the printed circuit board. One of them, in fact, was located. They used to use that as the switch to switch at different speeds. Was located right behind the head, right behind the recording and playhead, video recording and playhead, right behind it with a little box, and it had that relay in there. And I remember I used to pop the cover off that relay and clean it up, just spritz it out with a little cleaner, and that took care of it. But then they had one that was on the board also. And I remember that was the problem. That relay would close or whatever in, I try to remember it a number of years ago, and cause that problem of it not going into putting the tracking system in operation correctly, Dick. That rings a bell with me because I have several of them. Go ahead.
I think we're going to eventually get to the bottom of this one, Paul. And reasonably complicated problem. Guess you're going to have to keep hacking away at it. If I was in your shoes, I'm not quite sure what my next approach would be, but you're going to try all of the above. You've done some of the cleaning, or you just came to us because you want to make sure that when you start the cleaning process, you don't do any further damage. And I think you're about to do a thorough cleaning and inspection job. Is that true, Paul? WS2N K2RIW?
Yeah, the only cleaning I've done is with these cleaning tapes that you could buy by Maxwell, and I've used that, and that works quite well to really clean up the picture. But in fact, I used it on my other VHS and cleaned up that picture as well. That's the only cleaning I've actually done of it, so I figured let me find out about these chamois sticks that everybody on the internet was recommending, and that's how that all started. But a little bit of knowledge is a dangerous thing, as they say. I just have a comment for, really a question for Rich. When he says it's going to a blue screen, I wonder if he's watching this on a high-definition TV, where when you get a loss of signal, the blue screen comes up. Is that the blue screen that he's talking about? Or is it just a blue screen, you know, being produced by the tape? Because, you know, that's what happens with me. You know, if you put this on an older TV, you're not going to see the blue screen. You're just going to see loss of picture. The picture's just going to go away. The reason the blue screen comes up is because there's an actual total loss of the signal coming out of the Magnavox. And when there's any kind of loss of signal going to these new HDTVs, that's what you're going to see. That's what I see on mine. But I just had that question for N2EO. Back to you, Dad.
Get back to me, Dick. I'll tell them how to proceed.
Okay. Rich first, and then Mel in that order. Rich, answer that question for Paul. Go right ahead, Rich.
Okay, Dick. Yes, it is an HDTV using an HDMI input. And to answer Mel, these are not bootleg tapes. They're legitimate tapes with the MGM and the Warner Brothers label. Back to you, Dick.
You got it, Mel.
That wasn't the question, though, but that's great. Rich, the picture, when it turns blue, what are you looking at? Are you looking at a blue screen from your that says no signal?
Yes, I did say that. I did say that when I went to Mel's previous question. Yes, it's a blue screen and it says no signal. It's an HDTV looking at the VCR, exactly.
Oh, okay, very good. I'll give it to Mel, because when Mel was talking about it, I got the impression Mel wasn't thinking, he was actually thinking maybe a blue picture, you know. But when you have that loss of signal on the new TVs, you get it just no signal, and everything turns blue, and then of course, comes back with the tracking. Back to you, Mel.
Okay, he's getting this dropout. That will happen. I've seen that on tape. And these were pre-recorded tapes. And I think there was some kind of hocus-pocus going on because, as you said, the same movie recorded by another company, and there's no problem whatsoever. So I'm going to rule out the machine, Rich. That's not the machine's fault. The problem that you're having, Paul, do you have availability of an oscilloscope? I'll give you a very simple hookup. That will tell you exactly what's happening, Paul, over.
Yeah, I've got an old Heathkit oscilloscope. One dial's a little scratchy. I got to change out this one pot, but it's okay. It's usable. Back to you.
Okay. You'll see that combination tracking and audio head. Now, you're going to put the scope on it, and you're going to play back a pre-recorded tape so that you'll get used to seeing what you're going to be looking for. Now, you'll find there's a couple of pins behind the head. There's a number of pins that protrude through the back of the little board that the head sits on. That's the audio tracking head, not the video head. You're not going near that. This is the head that's after that as the tape's running by. You'll see that tracking head sitting there. Now, you'll put the scope on, and you'll see one set of pins. You'll see, actually, you know, audio pulses, you know, up and down, just looks like, you know, modulated pulses. On the other one, on the other part of the head, you may not see anything in playback, but you'll know those are the two pins, I mean in record. Those are the two pins that are going to record the signal onto it. What you'll do then, in other words, first you'll find those two audio, you'll know, because you won't be able to identify the pins so simple. But this way you can identify them. You'll see the little bit of, you'll have to open up the scope most likely. I think you should be able to get enough gain out of the scope to see it. You'll see the audio popping up and down on it. And The other pin will be the tracking portion of the head. When you go into record position, you'll see a pulse, a tracking pulse on there. If you don't see that tracking pulse, there's no use going any further with anything mechanical. Then you got a problem there that it's not switching on the, or if it's not constant, or if it looks crazy, it's not switching on the record, that tracking pulse onto the tape for all over.
Yeah, I'm gonna guess B is probably the correct answer. Because the JVCs, read, I think, two articles regarding the JVCs, and they made Magnavox afterwards, and they had tracking problems, big time tracking problems. Now, they didn't say what those, you know, what it was, but you've described it. I'm gonna go look for these relays too, Mel. My guess is when you say an electronic problem, that could be it, right?
Sometimes it could be intermittent. In other words, a number of times what happens with those relays that get this little crud on the, you know, it's a very small relay. You're going to look, it's going to have a little plastic cover on them. You carefully can snap the plastic cover off. What I use is usually a razor blade, a single-edged razor, that you can just get into the corner of the relay cover and just pop it. It'll just pop right off. Very gently. Once you get that off, if you just spray it out or just run a piece of paper between the contacts, be careful, don't bend it. It's very easy to bend up this one of these relays. Some of them have a multi-contact. They have a number of contacts, just not one. It could be two contacts or four contacts in there. Just flip a piece of thin piece of paper right between them, back and forth. That'll burnish them a fall over.
Okay, yeah, I've done bigger relays before, but the small ones, not so much. But, I, you know, same idea, just got to be real careful. We're good at that, Mel, so we'll try that. Very good. I guess back to you, Dick, WS.
And let us know how the saga goes, because some of us have got a whole lot of video cassette recordings that we value. We don't have the time to convert them over to a more modern medium, so we're going to be keeping these slightly ancient machines running, you know, as a sort of a classic case. I think the next person who signed in with a question was, could it be John? It could be John, KC2 Tango Bravo Lima. If you're still there, John, I hope you are, K2RIW.
Four EHL.
Are you signing in or giving us a suggestion, sir? Give me your full call letters and your name first. Go ahead.
Okay, I have none. Traffic. Go. My call letters is W4EHL. I'm from Orlando, Florida. I just been listening to you for the last hour and a half, so on all the stuff you've been talking about. Thought I'd just check in and say hi. I'm headed for Maine right now. Spent about an hour and a half on the George Washington Bridge.
Understand. Okay, the next person who signed in, hello to Orlando, Florida. The next person who signed in who had a question, I think, was, oh no, that KB1 November Hotel was a no. Bennett, maybe. K02 OK. Bennett, do you have a question for us? K2RIW. Okay. Does anybody have a question for us? Give me your call letters right now.
Whiskey 2, Echo Whiskey Kilo. No, no questions. Not yet. Maybe next week. Question mark.
Yeah, we skipped one person, Dick.
Yeah, who was that?
Harry, WA2JXM, had a question or a comment on an antenna problem that he brought up a few weeks ago, over.
Okay, Harry, WA2JXM, are you there? And if not, maybe we kept him too long. Okay, it looks like we got a little bit of blank time, if I understand correctly. That is because There's a brand new onslaught that's coming down on us. I've seen it in two issues now. This article appears in, let's see, what the heck issue is this that just came out? IEEE Microwave Magazine. I'm looking at the October 2009 issue, page 26. Also in the latest issue of Antennas and Propagation Magazine is the exact same article. Article written by a man named Rajiv Benzal, who is from the University of Connecticut. And the article is talking about what's going on in France, and the implication is also what's about to happen in the United States. There's been a number of lawsuits, you and I would say lost, not won, in France, with reference to the perceived risk of radio frequency biohazard of cell phone base stations. I'll read a little bit about this one. In France, where the bulk of the electricity is made by 59 nuclear reactors, so it looks like the French people are not afraid of certain kinds of technology. They don't have the usual amount of not-in-my-backyard philosophy. However, next front in France is the battle for limiting exposure, and that is in the town of Lyon. Some lawsuits have been lost where a cell phone base station was asked to be removed from the town because the residents in the apartment building next door were receiving nosebleeds and a metallic taste in the mouth that they were blaming on the radiation, so to speak, coming from the cell phone base station. They were putting tinfoil in the windows of their apartment on the side of the building toward the cell phone base station. And the article didn't say specifically what they did, but they were doing other protective measures. So you have a significant number of people in an apartment building in Lyon, if I understand correctly, that were taking these defensive actions. They brought a lawsuit, and they were successful in that the judge in the lawsuit said, yes, we cannot confirm that the base station was creating this problem. But because the residents are being made uncomfortable, the decision was made to order the cell phone
repeater timeout.
The decision was made to order the removal of the cell phone base station. And the removal did take place. However, the cell phone base station owner said, gee, this is crazy. We hadn't installed the antennas yet. The cell phone base station wasn't yet operational, and yet these residents were getting nosebleeds, metallic taste in the mouth, and putting tinfoil on the windows to protect themselves. You can sort of see what's going on here. If I combine those two articles that appeared in October 2009, IEEE Microwave Magazine, and also the latest issue of Antennas and Propagation Magazine of the IEEE, the exact same article appears there. Combine that with some recent articles in Newsday, among other places, which basically state, let me drop, they basically state that the Motorola company has come a little bit too close to the specification for specific absorption rate, the SAR requirement, which I believe is 1.6 watts per kilogram. In other words, when the cell phone is held up against your head, the placement of the antenna and the power output of the radio transmitter that's in the cell phone is such that...
At 8 o'clock net tonight. At 8 o'clock.
This is that net. That's crazy that that's still there. Anyhow, the signal coming out of the antenna, out the cell phone, against your head, when assessed for the nearest, I think it's gram of material, you're not allowed to exceed a specific absorption rate that's equal to 1.6 watts per kilogram, which, by the way, relates very close to the other radio frequency biohazard, which is a flux density of power flux density of milliwatt per square centimeter. Those two readings are very close to each other, but a little bit different, slightly different method of assessment. Because of all the phones that were rated, they claimed that the Motorola one was a little bit closer to the spec compared to the other. Well, the differences were not huge. The differences are very minor. But they decided to choose a particular brand or brands and to emphasize those. I'm relatively sure that this is a kind of alarmist reporting that's going on.